Dear God, thank you for all the opportunities you give us. Thank you for your grace in our lives. Thank you also for a world which we are able to discern between right and wrong, order, justice, and charity. Dear Lord, thank you for these events where we know that you also cater for your flock, you cater for your pastors, you allow for the creation and continued creation of your church in all aspects of life and in all places in Africa. Dear Lord, please bless our session and thank you for everything that you do for us. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, afternoon, I'm Peter Wassenaar. I'm not one of you in the sense that I'm a lawyer by profession, so I do not speak theological type events often. This is a rarity for me, so I do thank you for your time. This is a workshop, as Dr. Patrice explained to me, so I'm going to try and get us to be talking actively of what your concerns in practice and on a local level is. We can interrupt that and fear at the point in time. This is not a prepared speech or a lecture. I do have some slides, because if you don't talk to me, I'm going to give you a lecture. But hopefully we can talk about the challenges you face in a real day-to-day, real world level, in your ministry, or in your Bible school, wherever you are currently with your ministry. Can I just check, are there any of you outside of South Africa yet? Okay, everyone's from South Africa. This is quite a nice world. Oh, you're from outside of it?
Yeah.
From where are you?
From Kenya.
Kenya. Well, luckily your constitution is similar to ours, so this will also be helpful for you. Because it's very difficult for lawyers to speak outside of the realm of the law they're used to. And the South African law is very unique. We are seeing a lot of changes in the law. So I think before we run into the concerns you have, it might be helpful for us just to check one or two things that's going on currently in South Africa. So in the law in South Africa currently, we've got a very busy constitutional court and a very busy parliament. And they're busy with a lot of things that directly affect the Church of Christ. First, the Employment Equity Act. The churches aren't exempt from it. It will impose onto all walks of life a demographic view of society, meaning 43% black, 1.2% Indian, 1% colored, and 8% white, and we don't know what the rest is supposed to be. But the Employment Equity Act is a great concern, a great legal debate currently. I'm personally going to court for clients on the legality and the constitutionality of this act. On a personal level, as a believer, it goes against the Imago Dei principle, the image of God. We are dividing people according to race. And it's not done in a way where you can say it's really rectifying the past, it's destroying the future. We've got a departmentalization of occupations currently in South Africa, so we are seeing every occupation in South Africa being divided up into sectors. There are 18 sectors declared in the country, and they are putting regulatory bodies over every single sector. Mining, labor, whatever sector you might find yourself in, administration, the country, the parliament is creating regulatory frameworks, laws that will regulate you in all walks of life. They're going to require licenses for a lot of simple things we are busy with. Licenses to practice. The amendment of the marriage laws is on its way. It's going to most likely pass parliament by the end of the year, maybe early next year. That is where the biblical idea of marriage is thrown out of the window, and we've got this single term marriage, which will cover everything. I think the only relationship currently the bill does not cover is if it's a woman with four husbands. But a man with six wives, the polygamy and marriages, as long as it's a male multiple female one, and then all other forms of marriage is going to be on this single act. So if your idea is that you register a marriage under the laws of South Africa because it's biblical, you need to rethink that potentially in the future. The hate speech bill for pastors, for lecturers and people teaching, it's going to be a major issue, because any form of hate speech, and it's a lot broader than incitement to violence, if there's anything where you hurt the other person's feelings, even if I can simplify it like that, it's going to be a crime, you're going to jail. That one is currently before Parliament, before the Standing Committee. Discrimination Act, Tutura, to be amended, it would be unfair discrimination, unlawful discrimination, if you, for instance, talk against homosexuality. That's on its way, it's before Parliament currently. There's a new prostitution bill which was introduced in February, which will legalize prostitution in South Africa. Anti-money laundering bill will affect the churches. It's a new bill where you will need to declare your finances to the state as a church or donations. You will need to go and FICA all your donors. You need to get their identity. The state can come in and say, who's your donors? This is especially for churches a big issue, because one of the aims of the act is to have all non-profit institutions covered by this, because the state believes that a lot of money laundering and terrorist activities are funded by non-profits and churches and these type of funds. The regulation of religious workers is on the agenda of the Department of Home Affairs. They want to register all religious workers, most of you here. They want to regulate you, departmentalization of society, you're seeing. The World Health Organization is busy with health regulations as to vaccination, compulsory vaccination, for anything they, as the transnational body, feels is necessary for society. You have the centralization of, even outside of the sovereignty of South Africa as a state, where an international body will determine international health regulations, which are directly applied just for interest sake. We already have an act that allows for this, the 1974 International Health Regulation Act from 1974, which basically will now, this amendment before the World Health Organization will be directly transposed into South Africa. And we've got a lot of amendments to education laws, especially higher education. There's a few moves on its way there, which will affect Mukanyo, for instance, and which is all based on the idea of absolute equality, where we're going into a phase where equality is the measure of truth in South Africa for education. There's also the sexual education aspects, where we see it in the provinces, especially the Western Cape, where sexual education services are being brought into for 10-year-olds, 9-year-olds, all of this. It's very explicit. Actually, I'm working with a few groups in the Western Cape on this. It's horrible. And that's especially with regards to state-funded schools. Private schools have their own syllabus. State-funded schools exposed to all of these ideas. But that's where we're at currently. So the law and your ability to build the kingdom of God, it's not as easy anymore. The state really wants to regulate a lot of things in our lives. So I think before we go into the details of how the law affects you, I really don't want to go into the lecture, but just a little crash course into constitutionalism. There's a big difference between constitutionalism and constitution and constitutional law. Constitutionalism is based on a very old principle of the rule of law, freedom, equality in the old sense, not the new sense. That's constitutionalism. So when I speak about constitutionalism, I don't mean our current constitution. And I'll show you why. The first thing, when you plan, the entire idea of this crash course is for you as church leaders. So how do you plan your education institution? And how do you plan whatever projects you are busy as a church community or the education community.
And the first thing that we need to understand is what we call the God of the system.
Because if you understand what or who the God of the system is, then you can plan for it. That's very important for us to remember. This is one raise a point here, or discuss it, stop at any time.
But it helps us to realistically assess where we act as a society and where you as a church community must go when you plan your building. And it assists us to really prevent things like statism, where we're merely blindly following the laws of the land, a misapplication of Romans 13 often in church communities, where we come out of this tradition, the Christian consensus, we post-Christian society in South Africa, as we see from the laws. It's also why I have to give you this little brief of where we act with the law. The law is post-Christian in South Africa. So if we plan for the future, we cannot plan under this assumption that the state is in line with Romans 30. It's the authority of God being applied to man. The sword that Calvin and Luther talks about, where they enforce the law of God on society. So for us to build an independent institution, we need to recognize what's really going on, and then we really act in South Africa and across the globe. Kenya might be different, but in South Africa, we're no longer there, and so we built on a foundation of Christian consensus. So, what is the God of the system? I think there's three questions we can ask ourselves. What is the final arbitrator of truth in the system? Is it the Word of God? Or is it a constitution? Or is it a moral basis of transformation and egalitarianism? A lot of principles which are difficult in some senses to reconcile with the Word of God. And that's the first thing to determine. Are we functioning within a system where our God, the living God, is the God of the system or not? What is the dominant interpretative tradition in the system? What informs the hermeneutical approach to the interpretation of laws in the country? Because even though the constitution is there, a lot of these court cases are often through constitutional litigation. That's my forte. And you go to court, and then we fight about the same passage in the Constitution, the same section. We fight about the word said. The only reason why this happens is because we've got two conflicting interpretative communities, or two or more, that have multiple of that. How we value and weigh justice, how we value and weigh equality, how we value and weigh freedom, we see and apply the law differently. We read the same words and we apply them we apply different meanings to the same words. And that's important to recognize, especially this is language you guys are better prepared for than me, but a lot of lawyers don't recognize it. We are trained as positivists. We try to merely apply what the state projects onto society. That's usually the work of a lawyer. Unless you go into constitutional law, then your work is to fight whatever the state tries to project onto society. And then the last one is, how is morality and justice determined in this system? Okay, it's part of hermeneutics, so actually a lot deeper, it's rooted. What is the source of justice? What's the source of morality in the system? Is it determined by system players, by a democratic parliament that can vote in whatever they think is best for society? Or is there some higher constraint on this system, like the Bible or biblical values, which will limit the decisions we are able to make? So we recognize this, if we recognize all of this, it's clear that the God of the system in South Africa is secular. It's a secular constitution, even though it talks about God and religion. It's often in the constitutional court you use religious language. It's very often in the court judgments, especially in the constitutional court, we use religious language. But the God of the system is not religious. And it's difficult
it's difficult to plan if you don't recognize this, because otherwise you're just merely going to be informed by Romans 13 to say you need to adhere to this, and you merely start applying, but you don't understand this is part of a network of political moves, which unfortunately undermines often, not always, that's where Romans 13 does inform us to comply. So it is biblical, the rules of the road, the basic rules of honesty and theft and murder and all of this, those are biblical, we need to comply with them. But it's difficult to merely comply. And the danger is if you as an institution isn't critical about the law being man-made, you can often run into a situation where your organization walks blindly into a future risk where the state can come in and just dictate content of syllabus for you. The Higher Education Act, for instance, is going that way in the future. They want to have more and more control over this, the substance of teaching and education. So in these, if we differentiate between what I call the Christian consensus law, or society, constitutionalism, and a secular consensus, which is the capital letter constitutionalism, then we see there's a few differences which have a big effect on how we function in society. One is the recognition of the ontic law, the higher law, God, or natural law, as some people call it, or the formula-based rationalist expression of norms, which we see from a parliamentary state. Law can be tested against higher law in the Christian consensus. The system actors alone determine what is truth. They determine it. If the Constitution says X, the Constitutional Court reads it as X, it is X. You can, if you ever want to follow the most horrific work of the Constitutional Court, go and read the cases. There's about four of them on abortion. It's horrendous. It is a simple application of the majority principle and egalitarianism, based on life, and it's very strange. We've got, in the Christian consensus, the apodetic nature of law, it means it's a moral. The Ten Commandments are apodetic. It says, you shall not. It's both the rule and the norm in one. The secular law is causistic, so it says, if you do this, you will. But if we don't catch you, it's not immoral. But if we catch you, rather we've got you. And it's how it expresses itself, and then you've got negative rights and obligation against positive rights. Negative rights are there to restrain the state, where positive rights are there to empower the state. And what we see there is the state wanting to be a loving dictator or a loving ruler of people. So there's a lot of things the state does that are good, but they're empowered by the Constitution and say, no, you're not supposed to be good for people. You must be good for them, and you know what is good for them. So that's a big difference between those two. And then we've got multiple sources of authority under classical Christian consensus. The church is a very, very important source of authority. The church is very similar to a large extent to the courts, because we give judgment against the state. That's our only work. The courts are very weak. If the executive branch of government, for instance, police, doesn't come and enforce a court order, the judgment of court is worth zero. It's a piece of paper. Constitution itself is a piece of paper. Unless there's a willpower, political will to enforce it, it's worth nothing. But the church has a very similar role. The two kingdom principles that we ascribe to is that we give judgment. The church gives judgment against society, but it won't coerce you into that type of changing of ways, and judging. And then in the secular consensus, in the Christian consensus, we've got what we call politica. There's an old Reformed writer, Johannes Eutychius, he was a student of Calvin. He wrote about the book Politica, and the book is about the fact that you've got all these sources of authority in society that need to negotiate via politics, via politica. They need to negotiate rules and norms and justice and legislation, because it's not centered within a single state. Under a constitution, especially the South African constitution, you only have two sources of authority, actually only one. State is individualist nature. So in South Africa, It's the state, according to the constitution, and the individual. That's it. The rights of the individual versus the obligations of the state, the powers of the state. And that's the aim of the law currently in South Africa. The state is individualist, does not recognize, for instance, that the court has independent authority over its service. We saw it in 2020, when they closed the church by dictate. They didn't go and ask the church for cooperation. They didn't go and discuss it with the order of the state closing up. And if you look at, for instance, in the South African context, there was a big flu at the end of the turn of the century, where the old reformed, say the Dutch reformed theologians wrote to the state, the Dirk Posma is the one, where they wrote to the state and said, listen, where they also wanted to have mandates as to vaccination, closing of churches and stuff, where they wanted to compel it. They wrote a letter to the state, said, listen, this is not how we work. We've got authority over the church and our service. But this is not a factor in constitutional law in South Africa. It's only the state and the individual. Then Christian consensus, high emphasis on religious freedom, a lot of tolerance within the Christian idea of tolerance. See, there's a good book of Don Carlson, the totalitarianism of tolerance, of intolerance of tolerance, a conceptual book there on the table there. And within the secular sense, there's a very low tolerance for religious practice. So if we go to court in South Africa, court will see religious practice as important because the constitution says it's important, but they've got a very low tolerance for public religious practice. It's private, something contained within a private scene for the state. And then a high emphasis on truth on the Christian side for societal roles, offices. We think more of duties and obligations, meaning that you need to take certain offices. The office of the president is an office of society where you need to come in, you need to comply with certain requirements, and there's a high duty of care on you. That's how we, within the Christian consensus, think of office. Within office bearers in the church, the state emanates and mirrors what the Bible teaches in the traditional sense. And we've got a high regard of Imago Dei, the image of God. Within the state, we've got a high emphasis on egalitarianism, with generalization. You need to conform with the dominant view of society that the state wants to enforce. Now, luckily, the last 20 years, South Africa, we haven't seen a lot of this. But where we sit with this, we see a new doctrine of how a complete worldview of how society must order itself on its way. So it's going to go into your marriages. It's going to address and regulate your morality to a large extent. And that's a big change, shift away from a Christian consensus to a secular consensus. And I think the only point here I want to make is that the one good news we've got in South Africa is that the constitutional view that the courts in South Africa have of society is very, very limited, because it does not recognize the fact that you will not be able to regulate, fully regulate the church. All potent socio-economic and socio-political forces will make it very difficult to enforce that piece of paper. You see it on a good sense, you often see it with things like, whether or not it's good is a question, but the best example, for instance, is this e-tolling debacle itself in Pretoria. So we've got a law coming in saying you need to pay tolls when you drive through. No one complied. So the law on paper is worth nothing. We call it stillborn law within the view of small letter constitutionalism. But we also see it in regards to the uprisings in KZN. The moment people start uprising, when people become unruly, no matter what the reasons and the motivations for this is, the law on paper is not worth anything. We see it with municipalities. I do a lot of work on trying to fix these municipalities, a lot of court cases. The law says we've got one of the best laws in South Africa for municipal service, and public administration. We can't stop corruption. We can't stop the collapse within South Africa and the municipalities. We can't improve service delivery on paper. Real people need to do it. And if real people aren't informed by the gospel, informed by other norms outside of these models encapsulated on paper, it's not going to happen. Then just the constitution quickly. South African constitution is egalitarian. This is the dominant case for this, the Yehu case, where the constitutional court expressly said, this is, we are emphatically an egalitarian constitution. The law, all of the laws in South Africa must comply with the principle of complete equality. It's nice when you go out of a post-1994 society where there's a few wrongs for us to go and correct, quite a few wrongs. It's nice, these words, when the constitution was adopted for human dignity, equality, and freedom. Dignity is why I said. Human dignity, equality, and freedom, that's the founding principles of the constitution. They sound exceptional. When you go out of post-1994, it's exceptional. But now, 20 plus years later, court comes, well, this is actually not now recently, this is about 15 years ago. But the court comes and says, listen, yeah, dignity, your dignity to practice as your faith and to have a religious organization. That's all that's important. Freedom, to be free to do, conduct your life as you want. That's what's important. The most important principle of the Constitution is equality. And then we ask, what do we mean by equality? Because we, brothers and sisters in Christ, we've got a very specific view of equality. We are all equal in Christ. We're all equal in Christ. We all also have certain dignity because we are built in His image, created in His image. But then if we apply it onto what the country is busy with here, it's not necessarily what the courts and South African law sees when we apply this word. So our constitution, just a quick rundown. There's a lot of rights, obligations, the right to equality, human dignity, freedom of religion and opinion, freedom of expression, and right to education, very important for Mukanyo and other Bible schools. Everyone has a right to establish and maintain at their own expense independent educational institution. It's a constitutional right here. Probably the best provision in the entire constitution is that section. I've litigated on all the sections. This one is brilliant. Taken the Department of Higher Education to court, I think 3 or 4 times over the last 2 years because they don't want to credit or they just withdraw institutions as accreditation. We just go on this little clause. This is one of the few clauses that are negative rights. The state cannot stop you. It's a good thing, just like you Bible schools, keep in mind.
Just read it again, which one?
It's section 29 of the Constitution. Everyone has a right to establish and maintain at their own expense independent educational institutions. And then there's a few that do not discriminate on the basis of race, which is not difficult to comply with if you're a Christian, are registered with the state, and we can get to that point later, and maintain standards that are not inferior to the state institution, which are no longer difficult to maintain in South Africa, especially if you go to theology. Our first two speakers today speaks to most of this section here. So you've got a very, very strong right in law. It's very difficult for the department to withdraw you because you're Christian. And especially if you look at the right to freedom of religion and belief, which is also there. Then you've got language, cultural, religious, and linguistic community. You've got the right to form community and to express yourself within your community. Still private sphere, but it's at least there. So there's a few bright little spots of light there in the Constitution, which is difficult for even a court of the egalitarian court to get past. But they do, but difficult. But then just important, all these rights, if you read the Constitution, if you sit there with a problem in your ministry, you grab the Constitution, and you read something, it works for you. This proves my point. Remember that all rights are always balanced with other rights. There isn't a thing like an absolute right in South Africa and any legal system for that fact. All rights need to be placed in proper balance because free expression, until you start defaming someone, and ruining their character. Free religion, until you start throwing doom into your person's face and pushing snakes down their throats, there is a limitation to it. Luckily, the Christian view currently, we'll see what wokeism does in the future. Currently, we're there in a nice moderate position, so it's rare for a reformed view of faith and life to be in conflict with justice. But, we don't need to go into this, but the South African worldview is not in complete balance, I think, with the Christian worldview anymore. So constitutional motivators, why education is important in institutions. You balance power. You as an educational institution or a religious institution, you are a problem for politicians. Because you work with real people, you inform them of the real morality and the real truth of life and society and how we should order our lives. That's also why politicians will always want to regulate and impose on education and religious organizations. You the counterbalance to statism. The church plays a similar role as courts, as I said, to judgment. If the church complies, the church remains silent whilst they strip people of their livelihoods. Then you, as a constitutional institution, you are also failing in your obligation as a church and society. And then you're an independent authority that undermines oppressive regimes. You organize real people around real places, which is very difficult to manage and maintain order from the union buildings or from Cape Town in the parliament. They rely on your cooperation for the law and society to cohesively work and operate. So that's the consensus view. And then I think this is some good news you can read there, but very important, the law requires consensus. And very important, for unjust states to enforce the law, they have to have a very high level of efficiency. So we are right in South Africa. They struggle to impose their own laws, the post office laws, for instance. There's an old law that says no one can send a package under 1 kilogram unless it's done via the South African post office. For 25 years, everyone sends it via Takealot service and Postnet and courier smaller packages, or you send it via registered post, via Postnet. But there's very few packages that fall under that description that complies with the law. Post offices in any got. It's under liquidation. I was part of it. Because they don't pay their customers anymore. But these norm formulations, these powers, unless they're very ruthless and very efficient, which is their potential always, it's very difficult for them to force compliance with laws. And that's one of the good news of how society works. It's not mechanical. It relies a lot on human beings to work. So you as an institution, and I think here we can maybe ask a few questions. That's just the background here. If you go as an institution, we plan, keep this in mind. There's a very difficult framework of laws for us to operate in. But how do you enshrine your biblical values, your Christian reformed character in your church? Or in your educational institution. The first thing is your structure. There's threats, internal threats that you need to recognize and you need to manage for. Especially if you're a new Bible school or you're a few years old but you haven't really thought of structuring your institution, it's important to know who's the decision makers, who's the handbrake to the teachings of your institution. You need to build rules and internal documentation and structures to protect you against that. That's especially in the founding documentation and values of your institution. The best thing any biblical Bible school or educational institution can do is to have a statement of faith. And you can go and copy Macarius. It's very good to have a strong biblical statement of faith and have all your educators, all your staff, you can even have your students sign it if you want. But all your decision makers, everyone in the operational side of your institution must sign that document. And it is difficult. They can drag you to the CCMA, but at least you've got a legal basis on contract to let someone who's guilty of false teachings go in your organizations. More difficult often is to manage students and parents. And that's why the law is not going to help you here. You can have a student agreement. We also sign for it, especially if you train pastors. Your pastors need to sign a statement of a formulation of faith where they agree to the confessions or whatever organization wants to enforce. And you can let the student go, for instance, if they contravene that statement of faith. But this is where your biggest threat often is, your staff, students and parents. And there, the only way really to combat it is to make sure you've got a very visible and loud voice as to what you believe. It must be so difficult for other people who do not share your beliefs to maintain themselves within this institute, or to even come into it and say, oh, we didn't know, or come in and to disrupt. If you regularly and often and loudly expand on your views and express your views in your organization on a sociological level, psychological level, is very difficult. But the nice part is, on a legal level, it's going to be very difficult to fight you in court or in the CCMA, because you can come with a stack of evidence, which will be very difficult for a CCMA or even a court to go through and say, listen, here it is, this is all the time that this student was here where we expressed our biblical views. They're actually now trying to impose their views on a religious body. And you must frame your institution not as a higher education or education institute. You are a religious body. It must be very expressly stated somewhere within your, and regularly in your framework, that you're not a mere university. You're not a mere higher education institute. You are a Christian or a Reformed or a Baptist. Reformed Baptist, whatever you are, this is what we are. Because legally it gives you standing before the court to defend the position you've taken. You'd never ever in law want to be there where you need to explain your position. The other party must come to court and explain why your position is wrong. Not that it is your position, that everyone must understand it is our position of faith. And it's a legal strategy. This is not merely psychological. External risks, we've got the state legislation, media, activist groups. Again, the same principle apply. Be loud, be unscrupulous, or unapologetic about who you are. Make it very clear. Be very biblical about it, because it's very difficult to really go against your biblical norms. A few areas in society where you might expose yourself if it goes on sexuality, the role of sex, gender, and abortion, and life, and these bigger picture themes. There they might, you might be in a proper political fight. But in regards to your character and the basics of your institution, you can't get around this legally. If you're loud, clear, and explicit about it in your documentation. Legislation-wise, just quickly, you do not need to be accredited to teach. Everyone does education. You teach your children, you teach your flock at church, you teach your congregation, you teach your employees. Not all training, not all education needs to be registered with the state. It's only in terms of law in South Africa, the Higher Education Act, that you need to register with the Department of Higher Education if you want to give it up a degree. The word degree is reserved. And then a higher education diploma or higher education certificate. So very important, especially Bible schools. Bible schools where you teach a domination, you prepare for vocation and pastoral work, have a piece of paper where it needs to just state expressly with the student signs saying, this is not a degree or a higher education qualification, you are not accredited. And have them sign by that, because there's nothing wrong in law or on contract for you to teach people to be a pastor, to be a mechanic, or to be any form of vocational work, even though it's academic in nature. You can do, but you can't hold yourself up to afford the degrees. You can give them a certificate, it's nothing, diploma even, but you can't call it a higher education requirement. It must be expressly stated that this is not an accredited degree. If you do that, you're the degree, you don't need to do anything else. And the reason, therefore, is also letters of credence. In my denomination, we send letters of credence when you go to meetings, church meetings. Our congregation sends a letter of credence, a geloofsbrief. You send a letter of credence saying, Peter Wassenaar, or the Brandenvries, they are from our congregation. You can believe them when they talk on our behalf. Same goes for church denominational group. If you send a letter saying, we have examined X, Y, and Z, he knows hermeneutics, basic preaching, he knows the New Testament, he knows the Old Testament, he understands how to be a pastor, he's got some pastoral training. We vouch for him. That's basically what an informal certificate does. There's nothing wrong with it. So this is these letters of credence, and that's where we need to just keep in mind. If you're registered, you need to comply with the rules. If you're unregistered, don't pretend to be registered. That's the only caveat. Then the state, how do you protect yourself against the state? Hard targets. It's, I think the last 15 years in practice, it's very difficult for the state to take on a hard target. What does that mean? You're not small. Meaning, it doesn't matter that you're a small congregation, or you're a small Bible school, but you're not small. If you're here today, you're not small. You're part of a bigger group of churches, where if they take you on, the rest of the group will probably turn on them. It's not easy to take on hard targets. It's easy to take on isolated soft targets. And in law, when they, in COVID, for instance, a lot of people reached out to me to help them with these permits they issued. Those little, you can't travel, you can't go to work, you can't. So a lot of pastors traveled and got into trouble because of this. And I can remember quite vividly one incident because it is a pastor in Soweto. I live in Pretoria. Pastor in Soweto was arrested 7 times in March till end of April for going to church, opening his congregation, doing his soup kitchen, his food program, going to work and preaching the gospel. He was arrested 7 times. And I helped him on a pro bono level. Now, after I drove to Soweto 7 times during the hard lockdown, nice, no one's on the road except the military and me. And we go there, and I go to the police because his congregation is across the street from the police station. And I will go and say, I'm here for Pastor XYZ. Say, yes, he's here again. And we sign a few forms and he's out again. And after the 7th time, even though the lockdown was never lifted, the police just stopped. They stopped messing with him. So they said, listen, this guy's not going to stop. It's not helping us in the community because he's just a hard dog and he's very loved in the community. So they've actually figured out it's making our policing ability more difficult in that little area. And they stopped. He was a hard target. But he was also isolated. Had he not been able to contact the lawyer, it would have been difficult. But if you're part of a bigger educational or religious group, it's not too difficult to rally up a few people to make you a hard target. So on an educational level, you guys need to start thinking of this. How do you make an educational network? This is not a bad idea to start with this TSA.
Yeah.
How do we make ourselves a hard target for the state? If in the future the Papua, the discrimination or the hate speech bill comes in and they start pursuing one or two of you in your congregation or in your practice. And it requires a real world institutions, networks, real networks. It's not a legal strategy. It's a legal strategy because we know it works, but it's like no one wants to go after difficult people. It's too difficult. They go after the people who's easy to prosecute, people easy to lock up. It's true in any country across the globe. So be our target. Okay, practical advice, and I think here we can maybe have a few questions, or we can talk a bit. Statements of faith, institutional safeguards on your management, your control, have a constitution. Small one, you can Google it, go copy whatever grouping, you can read it, because the law is obvious. If it looks good and you see, that's how they appoint their board members. It makes sense. We can do this. Get this on paper. You don't need a lawyer always to draft it for you. Even if it's not technically perfect, it's better than nothing. A Bible school, for instance, the only rule you want is say that you're connected to a denomination or a specific congregation. This council will appoint our board. You protect it. That's a good way to do it. Do the paperwork. Make sure, even if you're a small Bible school, make sure you do the paperwork. Keep records. If something happened, write it down, send an email, take photos, record the meeting. It's not unlawful to record a meeting. If you don't need to tell the other party you're recording.
You don't have to?
No, we don't have two-party authentication rules in South Africa. As long as you're a party, it would be unlawful for me to put myself in there and record you guys whilst you talk behind my back and I go to the bathroom, you know. But that would be unlawful because that's a crime to listen into other people's conversation. It's not a crime to record them. So if you're in a position of risk, you record them. If the police harass you, put your cell phone in your pocket and put it on record. It's not unlawful. And as a lawyer, only once in my career I used the recording. And it's against a lying person who's not speaking the truth. I've never used a recording against a person who speaks the truth. And it's not unlawful, so keep records. If there's a threat in your institution, if it's a student, a parent, a state, don't ignore it. Deal with it immediately. Get either a lawyer or some external advice, get another educational group to come and assist you with advice if you feel the decision is difficult. But don't leave it because it festers and it shoots roots in your organization. If it's one student or one lecturer who's spreading false doctrine, if you don't deal with it immediately, you can have two or three or four. And legally, three or four, five people in an institution becomes a hard target. It's difficult legally to remove them. One person, easy. Three, four, five, very difficult. So if you don't deal with threats immediately, it becomes a major problem for the institution. And then proper oversight by overseers. So your syllabus, the teaching of your school, your teachers, your students, you need to have overseers. A board or a church council that comes in every now and then and checks on it. But if you don't oversee, if you don't measure, you can't manage it. And it will surprise you one day. A lot of churches are in disconnect with their church council, for instance, because they're living there in Mount Kukulu and they're not understanding what's going on the ground. A lot of JSE companies have the same problem. The state often has the same problem. So proper oversight on the ground with real people is the way, best way for you to protect your institution. Okay, that's my little presentation. Anyone, is there specific issues or fears you have in relation to the law, educational institutions, or what you're facing on a ground level, your Bible school or your church, that you want to discuss in view of this? Do you want to talk some hard politics, maybe? We can even do that. I don't know if anyone has a question. Yes.
Thank you. My question is the first part, the part of the gift. Is it not the right of the state to have this deal to control?
Constitutionally, yes. The state has the right to bring in laws. Let's take it back to a biblical view. So the state has a right to bring in laws. But in the Christian consensus, it's restrained by higher laws, the laws of God. So constitutionally speaking, they've got a right to create whatever law they think is appropriate or should be brought. We've got a lot of remedies in law currently still in South Africa for us, for instance, to oppose a lot of this, whereby the Bill of Rights, these constitutional rights I showed earlier, is often the locus of our fight. We go to those, we go to the right of religious freedom and say that this hate speech bill, which will make it a crime for a pastor to preach against homosexuality, it is unlawful because of the right of religious association, religious community, the right to have a faith. It's not lawful for them. But it doesn't, it still means legally they've got a right to create a law. It doesn't mean that the law is just or constitutional or lawful even. There's a lot of laws we strike because, for instance, the government exceeds its powers. And that's often where the fight will come with all of this.
No, thank you. I think, because while I was sitting here, I was just asking myself that I understand the point of the state, but also now, is it not going to be look like we are against the state differently when we question some other bills and stuff like that?
Yeah, you see, the church has, for some reason, taken this idea of piety to the extreme. We need to be holier than, for some reason, we shouldn't fight the state. We should cooperate. It is true. We should cooperate with the state. Romans 13, for instance, is the rule there. But we shouldn't ignore, for instance, 1 Samuel, where Israel asks for a king, and God says, well, Samuel says, listen, but you know he's going to enslave your children. You know it's going to be hard. There's a lot of hardship to follow your king. So as much as God gives authority for the state, and you the theologians, you must assist me, but as much as the state is ordained and an institution created by God for the benefit of man, it's still human beings inside of that operation. And that is where we should discern between unjust wars and just wars. We should discern between the Christian consensus and the secular consensus. When we oppose the state of unjust laws, we are acting on behalf of the entire community. We are not in opposition of the state. We are calling the state to order. That is biblical. How often did the prophets not go to the kings and call them to order?
2 Corinthians 4, verse 4. In this case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel, the glory of Christ. Normally, of course, we comply, but in some cases, the God of this world, Satan, has blinded the minds of the state. And in that case, it's our job to call out their blindness with the light of the gospel. And so I think it's in these cases, we gotta know, be discerning which of these cases are. But in the case of marriage, for instance, if it's anything other than how Jesus defines marriage, the God of this world has blinded the eyes of the state. And we are duty-bound to call it out.
Yes.
Thank you. So I had kind of 2 questions, one related to education in South Africa, and obviously being an outsider, I'm asking it more to understand. And then, because I'm a missionary coming into work here, a question on that too. So the first question would be with the issue of the BEE, and I know they've just passed a new version to bring it, to make it, as you said, more equal. But as an institution that, by the nature of our theology, would value diversity, but is constrained in how we express that diversity in our faculty and our staff by a statement of faith. How do you see that law impacting the hiring and retention practices, and particularly if you're like an institution that's serving a denomination that historically is weighted towards a certain group, now suddenly you're pulling your staff from that group because that's the group you are catering to. It would seem the BEE could cause you problems legally in that, because you're doing what's best for your denomination, but in violation potentially of that law. So how, the first question is, how can institutions build diversity and honor the statement of faith if the talent available doesn't allow you to conform in the way the state is asking you to?
Okay, so you've got a second question as to...
And the second question being the missionary is, we are seeing increasing difficulties with the visa situations of outsiders coming in. And how do you see the current legal situation and perspective of the government towards that affecting the giving of visas to religious workers? I mean, you mentioned the registering of religious workers, which would affect everybody inside and outside. It'll have a double effect for missionaries like myself. But also, if you have institutions that have been bringing in missionaries as an added voice, but they're tightening and limiting the visas, that now creates a further constraint on, especially if most of the evangelical voices you are using are coming from outside of the country because of the charismatic influence within. Now suddenly one of your avenues for bringing in an evangelical voice is being shut down potentially. How do you see the developments on that front?
Okay, no. So let's first start with the Employment Equity Act. Firstly, the act was only signed 6 March into law, 6 April into law. There's still new regulations to come. The minister has published regulations, which has this 43% 1.3% Indian colored, all of this in place. Those regulations have not yet been promulgated, and it's only likely that the act, the amendments, will come into effect after all the court fights are done, hopefully, and there's clarity as to whether it's constitutional or not, or we're estimating somewhere end of the year, September, October, November, potentially. That's what the president said. End of January, they're planning to bring it into effect in September, October. But due to all the court cases going to be issued currently, there's currently already 6 or 7 parties going to the constitutional court on this. So the fight might take a year or two. So it's at this stage, you don't need to comply with anything. It's not yet effective law. But we need to start, at least on an institutional level, talking about how we're going to deal with it. Because the brutality of this law is that it aims especially to correct the past, let's say, apartheid and white majoritarianism. That's the little veneer of politics they throw on top of it. The real veneer, the real truth around this is they want to have a completely demographically based society where there's one of you here, one of us here, one of them here, one of they want to take the national demographic profile and impose it on every business, institution, organization in the country. That's the effect of the law. And that's also the policy, and there's a lot of political statements and policy documents that actually directly addresses this is the actual idea. So the idea is the public voice is we're going to correct the past and racism and workplaces and all of this, but the actual brutality of this, they don't want to have a 100% black church even, or black organization. You need to meet all the quotas that the state gives you. That's where the brutality comes, especially to the point that you made, say that my institution focuses on specific cultural groups in South Africa. Do you know what a trifle is, the pudding? You know a trifle? South Africa is not a melting pot of cultures, we have a trifle. It's a proper mess of everything, but it's actually quite tasty and nice. But they don't recognize the fact that, listen, there's differences here. It doesn't consider that. It is a hard-handed law that comes. Currently, the law will exclude anything under 50 people, 50 employees. So if you're smaller than 50 employees, you're exempted from it currently, but that number can be dropped to 10 or 1. But it's not effective yet. Then the question is, what should you do? On a Christian level, not legal advice, you can't comply. It's impossible. Because you will most likely not get the people you want. You will not be able to commit to your mission, your calling. So you will most likely you won't be faithful to your calling as a mission. So I don't think you can. It's part of the argument before court, because the brutality of this is our brother from Kenya, for instance, will not qualify as black. You and I are white, because you are not part of the scheme of black South Africans. So if you and I are part of an educational scheme, you qualify under actually nothing. They don't even recognize you, because at least the white South Africans are deemed South African. So if you, for instance, a business that have a specific cultural ideal, or you're a church grouping with a specific, serving a specific cultural community, yeah, it's going to be difficult. The churches aren't deemed businesses at this stage, but the educational institutions and missions. So if you're a non-profit company, for instance, you will be deemed a business. You will fall under one of the sector codes. A church won't, but everything else will. And the brutality behind this is that it will exclude a lot of our brothers and sisters in Christ from a lot of these areas. So what should you do? I think the churches must really think about raising a voice against government in this regard, public voice, because of the brutality of this thing. It doesn't even work in the same way that BEE does. BEE has the state who gives out tenders, so using public finance, public tax, to allocate contracts for infrastructure work or all types of work. So they're handing out work and they say, well, we're going to give preference to black people. Whether or not politically or morally that's a problem, it's not even the point here. That one at least relies on the state as the dominant actor in the relationship, and then potentially all the service provider down the food chain. But the employment equity, it goes into the heart of your organization. It cuts. The state is given discretion as to how the makeup of your institution looks. And that is a problem. And you as a foreign person will, for instance, not qualify even as the white part of it. It's a very xenophobic law, actually. Just think if you want to go to... if I want to go and get food from an Indian restaurant, it's a big one, for instance, or a food chain, they've got more than 50 workers. Honestly, if I want a bani chow or curry, I want it from an Indian person, because it's culturally appropriate. It's unlawful for them to have that. So it's not a white-black thing anymore. This is the state going into the heart of institutions, which is more problematic. It's not using publicly funded tax. It's going into the private sphere completely now. Regarding the visas, the problem with the visas is exactly the same problem. It's also the Department of Labor. They see everything at a demographic level. So when they assess a visa for you to come in as a religious worker or a missionary, the first question they ask is, yes, but isn't there South Africans who can do this job? And that's where the problem is, because it's xenophobic. It's only concerned about South African registered people or citizens, and it is also demographic. So it also considers your race when it is applied to it. Luckily, the focus is now all on employment equity, and no longer on that. So I've heard I'm part of a few foreign missions and foreign mission and a foreign company, and our members have filed suddenly. It's easier to get it, but I think the reason is that all the energy and labor and manpower is on this bill now. So in the future, most likely a very similar type rule might apply to your visa also. But this is new. All of this shift in government's focus on race from the all BE to this is post 2018. All of these laws came in the legislature in 2018, and it's post just after the election in 2018. After 1918, now it's around the election that all of these laws suddenly came on the books. So it's very new. We don't know what the Constitutional Court will do. The Constitutional Court is also a new bench under Zondo. A lot of good judges on the Constitutional Court who are relatively moderate, so we don't know where we're at with the Constitutional Court, because they haven't really started giving out judgments. Our constitutional court is very conservative when it comes to everything except race. So when it comes to these race laws and sexuality laws also, we don't know where we're standing yet, but hopefully God will also make the minds of our judges, and that's why I think we need to really pray for the politicians firstly, and that they come, they really think about what they're busy with, but the courts. The courts will be the arbitrators of this.
This is a short question. If I have a course which is not accredited, can I hand out a certificate
yes.
or a diploma?
Yes.
Not a higher certificate?
Yeah, my daughter got a diploma for some gymnastic trick she did the other day. It's not a normal. So the fact that you at a higher level than my daughter's gymnastics teacher is irrelevant. The certificate must just have a statement on it saying this is not an accredited diploma or an accredited certificate. So as long as when you take in the student, when you teach them, maybe do get a piece of paper where you say, we are not an accredited training, this is biblical training we're doing, or whatever the reason is that it's not accredited. And have them just sign a paper, it's a good way to protect you. And the certificate itself, it's always good to have a little small amount and say, this is not an accredited course. But if you do that, diploma is not reserved by the law, certificate is not preserved by the law. Only degree, never put degree on it, and you're going to jail.
I think the word diploma might also be reserved.
No, it's not.
It's not. Interesting. My question is dealing with sexuality, that whole space that's coming, I think. So Mukanyo trains men for pastoral leadership,
yes.
men and women for Christian ministry.
I'm not talking, he's talking. He says it's 5 minutes.
So we train men for leadership, men and women for ministry.
Yes.
Which means we don't train women for pastoral leadership.
Yes.
But we've said it carefully. Now, let's suppose that's challenged
yes.
by a student. What,
yes.
How do we protect ourselves in that case?
You come to me and I will go and fight it.
How do we prepare for that?
How you prepare for it is to have your statement of faith very clearly. And I would say to build the cause around the office as we publicly define it. To make sure there's a very clear definition as what the qualification requirements of this course is. And that it is not just a course for you to have an education, it's a course that prepares you for an office in the church. Because now if you then have the education, because that course, for instance, yes, someone might recognize that diploma or degree or certificate, someone else, except outside of the church community. But in essence, you're preparing someone for calling. And it's very nice to give our pastors accredited degrees and diplomas. But in essence, in reality, I'm a lawyer now 14 years. And in that time, I've never ever been asked for my legal degree, my admission as an attorney, except a big insurance company who approached me for work. They just wanted it for the records. I want that. And never ever as a client, because all my clients are referred to. Either come due to our public name or due to another client or another person saying, listen, those are the people for you. Now, the church operates in a very similar way. The church self-recognizes people. So I would build my course within the description and qualifications of this course very specifically. So this course is designed for preparation for eldership teaching eldership or pastoral work within the framework of the Reformed tradition.
We've made the qualification open to men and women, but we've made the elective modules open to only men.
Yes.
And as long as we specify that on those modules, this is for men only.
I'm not saying to you you're going to win the case.
I know.
But I'm saying you're going to have a fighting chance, so
right.
Do it.
Okay.
You honor your calling. You can't be unfaithful. So, but legally, as a lawyer, if you're explicit as to what it is before someone starts with it, they can't come and complain afterwards. The law actually has a presumption against them that they actually knew what they're in and they're reckless or they're not acting properly towards you as an institution. So be very explicit in your formulations of your modules and as to why and what. And even if it's an elective and your course is open for everyone, but that module isn't, maybe at the start of your course, have a piece of paper where the student says, listen, I understand when I subscribe as a student to Zipacanyo, these courses are X, Y, and Z.
Okay. We have our women, our female students sign.
All students, the standard course.
Okay, how about if we have a staff member who it becomes public that staff member is homosexual or lesbian?
Yes.
And our code of conduct is that you must be in good standing with the local church and must subscribe to biblical values as in your lifestyle. And then we need to terminate according to code of conduct. How can we protect ourselves to make that process easier?
Well, there's a very famous case in South Africa, the Lange versus the Methodist Church of South Africa. It was in court in 1614 somewhere in the Constitutional Court. So it's very difficult. That's where the egalitarianism of the state comes in. Last part of this, I would say, have like a remuneration fund ready to settle whatever the court orders you to pay at some point. You need to budget for that risk. And it's lucky once, it's a moonshot risk. It's going to be one or two people, potentially, hopefully never. Legally, you've got two courses of avenue. The first is that you have them removed right on the technical level by their church, because then they're disqualified. As your requirement, you must make sure that the church takes action, or alternatively, you suspend them immediately pending the church process, or you do your own discipline and you confront your position with the law directly. But legally, it's not. Homosexuality is probably the most difficult legal position for a Christian education scheme institution.
Just as a follow-up to that, do you anticipate that statements of faith will start to need to include statements on sexuality and gender? Because if we simply say biblical values, but there are churches that would maintain that the biblical value is an acceptance of homosexuality, would that now create a defense that is too vague to be to stand up? So you actually have to define
you need to be value as be explicit as to all the biggest contentious issues in politics and society on paper. If your biggest risks have a policy on it, then if they want to come and take us on it, they need to take on the policy, and it's not seen as a purely arbitrary decision by a board that is. At least that if we need to fight something, it's not you personally as a board member needing to defend yourself before the court, your conduct. It is a policy where you need to be explicit about. The problem often with liberalism and progressive teachers, especially and students, is that they will rationalize their worldview within that same statement of faith and that same church order and that same confessions as us, because they don't read the same, the words mean differently to them, and they don't actually care. They impose their view onto everything. So to be explicit is probably the best defense. The risk of that, there is a risk. The risk of it, it makes it an easy target for them to identify, because a lot of these institutions go and read through all these statements of faith. They go through, you get, I'm struggling to remember the group's name, but there's a relatively radical progressive group. We defended them, the schools case in 2016 in South Africa. I was part of the legal team who fought the religion and schools case, where the atheist group wanted to take out religion and school. And they identified six primary and high schools in South Africa. And the cases they cherry-picked were the cases where the website, where these Christian biblical values were expressly stated on the website. The difference there is that it's public schools. Your private institutions, it's a lot more difficult for them to take on private institutions unless it comes from within a faculty member or student. It's rare for them to come from an external source, but it is one of the risks, and that's, I think, a business decision, a risk decision that your institution needs to take. You can either have the broader statement of faith and leave, knowing that no one will be able to directly pin a homosexuality case on your website due to that. We have it explicitly, and you know you've got a strong legal case on the fact that you've always said this to people. So it's a bit of a choice you need to make where you position this information and if you even want to do it. A lot of institutions follow the course of, listen, let's hide away. It's a good legal strategy to hide yourself from these policies is a very good legal strategy. Because if they can't find you, they can't prosecute you. They can't go after you. So not to be explicit is also a good choice. It's a bit of, it's a Sophie's choice. I don't know which one you should choose. If I go to court, it's going to be a big fight. But if they see this on paper, they're anyway going to take you to the Human Rights Commission. So to either way might also be a good idea.
So could you have your broad statement of faith that are the essentials and then have basically like a position paper where you lay out that the position of our institution on this issue, here it is, here's the biblical basis for it, and this is the way in which we will observe this in the operation of our organization, so that wouldn't be posted where it's easily visible.
Yeah.
But if brought to court, that can be brought up and presented as
evidence.
We have this, it's always been this way, we're following this, so you can see the consistency of belief.
Yes.
And the basis by which we deem it a religious belief and not a political belief.
Yes, that would be a good strategy. Like I said, to avoid and to hide is often a great strategy. Because the church has always, for its early millennia, or a few hundred years, the church operated in hiding. So I think it's very biblical for the church to, and as far as an institution, it's biblical to hide away. It's biblical to not be explicit about everything to the public, but internally it's important that all the players in your internal structure, students and educators at least, exactly know what they're in for, because on a legal basis and on a personal basis, it's a lot easier to deal with it. If you're not explicit about it, then you, Dr. De Vries, as the principal of Bukayo, he needs to go and argue with a lecturer whether or not the confessions ban female eldership, for instance. How you can argue it with them. So I think to have it, as you explained, both hidden and explicit is not a bad idea. It's a good idea. There's no right answer with this. The law, if it's on paper, or even if it's in practice, with an affidavit by a witness, it's going to be before court. So it's a bit in that sense, I'm agnostic. There's no right or wrong answer. As long as you're able to prove a case, and the more clear the case is for the court as to what your position is, the better chance you have that your lawyers and the court will understand what you're talking about.
Yes, when we employ somebody at Mukanyo, can we at the employment interview ask the person, are you homosexually inclined? Can you ask such a question? Or would you rather say, Mukanyo holds the view that homosexualism is not supported by the Bible. Do you support that view? Would either of those questions be acceptable or not?
Yeah, if to ask a person whether or not they're homosexually inclined, I don't think it serves any purpose, because it's not necessarily they might be faithful. But I mean, on the factual level, the question should be, I think, do you subscribe to all our beliefs? You can have a question there beforehand, where they come there, you ask them, this is our beliefs, have you reviewed our statement of faith? Have you reviewed our policy on, or our position statement on X, Y, and Z? You send it to them. And then you ask them, do you conform with it in all its aspects? If you have any questions about it, it's not like the formulations of most denominations. If you need to subscribe to this, and remain silent if you differ, unless you properly raise the issue. So follow that same formula.
If you don't want to employ a person who practices homosexuality,
yes,
how do you protect yourself not to report such a person?
No, I don't think you can, because anything could allow. Interviews are very poor mechanisms to filter people. Very poor. The legal structure of having them positively and on, preferably on paper, affirm a position, it's a lot easier than to, that you can ask it. I don't think legally the CCMA, for instance, won't like the fact that you asked them. They might see it as discriminatory based on sex. And that's why I prefer it. We bring it back to faith. Bring it back to a religious question. Religiously, you ask X, Y, Z, B. Do you affirm with this? Do you conform with this in all respects? That's the question I would actually think is legally defensible, even with egalitarian view on sex and sexuality. Section 9 of the Constitution actually prohibits this and will deem it to be discriminatory if you purely focus on a person's sexual orientation. We operate in a church environment, so we are not conforming with this. But I think the safest way for an interview to follow is to ask the question, do you affirm with everything we believe? And you can read it to them, watch their reaction and all of that. But yeah, you can still ask it, but legally might be difficult to explain. Okay, I think 5 minutes is over 10 minutes ago. Thank you for your time, everybody.